Hopefully everybody turned off their cell phones. So today we're reading from the glorious Srimad Bhagavatam, first canto, chapter 13, text 15. The chapter is Dhritarashtra Quits Home. Translation by Srila Prabhupada. As long as Vidura played the part of a Shudra, being cursed by Manduka Muni, Aryama officiated at the post of Yamaraja to punish those who had committed sinful acts. Please repeat after me. As long as Vidura played the part of a Shudra, being cursed by Manduka Muni, Aryama officiated at the post of Yamaraj to punish those who committed sinful acts. Purport by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. Vidura, born in the womb of a Shudra woman, was forbidden even to be a party of royal heritage along with his brothers Dhritarashtra and Pandu. Then how could he occupy the post of a preacher to instruct such learned kings and kshatriyas as Dhritarashtra and Maharaj Yudhisthira? The first answer is that even though it is accepted that he was a Shudra by birth, because he renounced the world for spiritual enlightenment by the authority of Rishi Maitreya and was thoroughly educated by him in transcendental knowledge, he was quite competent to occupy the post of an Acharya or spiritual preceptor. According to Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, anyone who was conversant in the transcendental knowledge or the science of Godhead, be he a Brahmana or a Shudra, a householder or a sannyasi, is eligible to become a spiritual master. Even in ordinary moral codes maintained by Chandaka Pandit, the great politician and moralist, there is no harm in taking lessons from a person who may be by birth less than a Shudra. This is one part of the answer. The other is that Vidura was not actually a Shudra. He was to play the part of a so-called Shudra for 100 years, being cursed by Manduka Muni. He was the incarnation of Yamaraj, one of the 12 Mahajanas, on the level of such exalted personality as Brahma, Narada, Shiva, Kapila, Bhishma and Prahlada, etc. Being a Mahajana, it is the duty of Yamaraj to preach the cult of devotion to the people of the world, as Narada, Brahma and other Mahajanas do. But Yamaraja is always busy in the Plutonic kingdom, punishing the doers of sinful acts. Yamaraja is deputed by the Lord to a particular planet, some hundreds of thousands of miles away from the planet Earth, to take away the corrupt souls after death and convict them in accordance with their respective sinful activities. Thus Yamaraj has very little time to take leave from his responsible office of punishing the wrongdoers. There are more wrongdoers than righteous men. Therefore, Yamaraj has to do more work than other demigods, who are also authorized agents of the Supreme Lord. But he wanted to preach the glories of the Lord, and therefore, by the will of the Lord, he was cursed by Manduka Muni to come into the world in the incarnation of Vidura and work very hard as a great devotee. Such a devotee is neither a Shudra nor a Brahmana. He is transcendental to such divisions of mundane society. Just as the personality of Godhead assumes his incarnation as a hog, he is neither a hog nor a Brahma. He is above all mundane creatures. The Lord and his different authorized devotees sometimes have to play the role of many lower creatures to claim the conditioned souls. But the Lord and his pure devotees are always in the transcendental position. When Yamaraj thus incarnated himself as Vidura, his post was officiated by Aryama, one of the many sons of Kashyapa and Aditi. The Adityas are the sons of Aditi, and there are 12 Adityas. Yeah, we have one of the Adityas here. We see over here, Upendra. He is the 12th Aditya. Trivikram. Vamanadeva. Aryama is one of the 12 Adityas, and therefore it was quite possible for him to take charge of the office of Yamaraj during his 100 years absence in the form of Vidura. The conclusion is that Vidura was never a Shudra, but was greater than the purest type of Brahmana.
Omagyana timarandasya gyananjana shalakaya chakshurum militamena tasmai sri gurave namaha.
I was born into the darkest region of ignorance, but my spiritual master opened my eyes with the torchlight of knowledge. I offer my respectful obeisance unto him. As long as Vidura played the part of a Shudra, being cursed by Manduka Muni, Aryama officiated at the post of Yamaraj to punish those who committed sinful acts. The way that Vidura was born is explained in the Mahabharata. After the death of Vichitravirya, his mother Satyavati was very much concerned that there was no king on the throne. She knew, as Chanakya Pandit said, the land with no king, with many kings, with a woman as a leader, or with a child as a leader, soon comes to destruction. So she was very anxious that a king should be there. So first she asked Bhishma, "You please take up the role of king." But he refused. He said, "I have taken a vow. I have made a promise to your father that I shall not go on the throne. Only your descendants shall be on the throne." She implored him, but he refused. So then she remembered her son, Vyasadeva, who was begotten by Parashar Muni. Excuse me, Shanti. So Vyasadeva told her, "If you ever need me, just think of me and I will become present." So she thought of Vyasadeva and immediately became present. And she explained the predicament that we have no king, so therefore, according to Dharma, you can impregnate the wives of your brothers. So he told her, "Okay, I agree, but they have to perform severe tapasya for 1 year. Then I will embrace them and I'll give them a son. Because then only they'll be ready. They are princesses, queens, they're used to very lavish life. If I come to them in the way I am now, they won't be ready, because he is a very severe tapasvi." But Satyavati was very impatient. She didn't want to wait a year. She wanted immediately. So she implored him, she pushed him. So he was, being that he's her mother, she's her mother, his mother, he obeyed her, even though it was not according to his desire, because he knew they weren't going to be ready. So, according to providence, the arrangement was that he would immediately impregnate the girl. So they weren't ready. So as soon as he came to them, as he came to the first wife, she took one look at him and she closed her eyes, because he was dreadfully looking. He had all matted locks, hadn't bathed in locks. He was coming from the forest, very unattractive looking. She was used to seeing her husband all perfumed and well groomed and in nice clothes, and here comes this rishi, you know, wearing dilapidated clothes, terrible looking, smelled funny. So she just closed her eyes. But the son was born, Dhritarashtra, but because She had closed her eyes. Dhritarashtra was blind. But he was still the son of Vyasadeva, greatly learned. He was a Rajarshi. So then Satyavati said, okay, go to the second daughter, second queen. So went to the second queen. She took one look at Vyasadeva and all the blood ran out of her skin. She freaked out. She just became totally pale. But he impregnated her according to the desire of his mother. And he told his mother, well, because she became totally frightened, then the son will have Pandu Roga. He will also be very white. So Satyavati was unhappy with this. So he said, okay, go for a third time. Go back to the first queen. For the first queen, the first time was enough for her. She didn't want anything more to do with him. So instead, she substituted her maidservant. The maidservant was very submissive, very humble. She embraced him very gladly. And a very good son was born, Vidura. But he could not be the king. He could not inherit the throne because his mother was not married to the king. She was she was a maidservant. So not only was he born the son of a Shudra, but the main thing was that he is not in line to get the throne. His mother is not the queen. So how he can become the king? Even today, you have to be born from the lawfully wedded wife of the king to inherit the throne. That's one reason. That's another reason. There's never just one reason. There's always multifaceted reasons for why these things happen. And then we see, but of course, as is described here, why he took birth at all was because Yamaraj was cursed by Manduka Rishi. So how is it that Yamaraj could be cursed? First of all, we have to understand that curses, according to Mahabharata, a curse can only be effective if there's truth in the matter. If something truthfully has been done wrong, then any curse against that person will have effect. This was explained in the first part of the Mahabharata when this one brahmana was given food by the king, and the food had hair in it. So then he cursed the king because you've given me impure food. And then the king became angry and he counter-cursed him. And the brahmana said, your curse has no effect because I didn't do anything wrong. But here's the hair. My curse is effective, your curse will not be effective. So a curse, for it to be effective, it has to be something actually done wrong. Not that you can just go around cursing people. Because that curse will not have any effect. So an actual fault has to have been done. Then the curse will be effective. Because then justice is being done. Because the brahmanas, they did not need the courts of law. Simply by their cursing, justice would take place. Manu says this. They don't have to bring any matter to the court. They are a law unto themselves. So Manduka Rishi, he had been unlawfully punished. So then Yamaraj, he asked Yamaraj, how you can do this to me? And Yamaraj explained, well, because when you were a child, you pierced some insect, therefore this is your punishment. You get impaled. And Manduka Rishi didn't think that this was fair. And obviously it's not fair. A child, what does a child know about right or wrong? So he was correct. He cursed Yamaraj. But as Sanatan Goswami says, how Yamaraj, how some great personality like Yamaraj could make such a mistake? Well, there are many facets to explain this, because it's always a multifaceted subject. Like in the case of Parikshit Maharaj, it was obviously a mistake to put a dead snake on Shamaka Rishi's meditating body. And it's totally out of character for Parikshit to do something like this. But Krishna had his intention. So he inspired Parikshit to do this. And also Sanatan Goswami explains in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita, second canto, chapter 3, verses 170 to 171, 72, that sometimes great devotees, I mean exalted devotees, they purposely do wrong things for several reasons. One of them is to hide the path of devotional service, to keep it a secret. And another reason is to show other people that they shouldn't do these things, because look, just see the reaction that they got. He gives the example of Bharat Maharaj. He was an exalted devotee, but by bad association, he had to take so many births. Or Yudhishthira. He's the cousin of Lord Krishna, the great personality, but he showed what is the reaction to gambling. Such as gambling, see the whole, just by gambling, what a sinful activity it is. Just see the reaction to it. So much tribulation. So there's or Nriga Maharaj. Nriga was also a great saintly king, but just see the reaction for improperly taking the property of a Brahmin. He had to take birth for thousands of years and live as a lizard at the bottom of a well. Just to show the example, just to show what is the reaction if you do something. So they purposely did this. But they are, we shouldn't think that we can do these kind of things because we're not on that level. But these are great devotees, Yudhishthira, Bharat. They purposely suffered to show others that's how compassionate they are. That they purposely suffered so that others could be benefited. So sometimes in our own life, Krishna had this desire also. He inspired them to do these things. So we have to always see, we have to always have great faith in Krishna that no matter what happens to us, it's been arranged by Krishna and it's always in our best interest. Just like this incident with Yamaraj. So what is the case with Yamaraj? Srila Prabhupada in another purport explains that Yamaraj is one of Krishna's GBC. Krishna also has a GBC. But if you do something wrong, then this is, if you misuse your position, you also will have to suffer. So he was instructing his GBC that don't think that just because you are in this position, you won't suffer if you do something wrong. You see, Yamaraj, he also had to suffer. So he showed the example of what happens if a person misuses his position. He has to suffer. So actually this curse of Manduka Rishi was a great blessing on Yamaraj. So sometimes something terrible might happen to you, but we have to see that actually it's been sanctioned by Lord Krishna. And Krishna, what does he say? In the 5th chapter of Gita, verse 29, Suridham Sarvabhutanam. I am the great friend and well-wisher of everyone. So we have to see that no matter what happens to us, what tragedy, what suffering is actually in our best interest, is actually for our benefit. I have personal experience of that. About 18 months ago, I was in a severe car accident, 12 broken bones, in the hospital for 11 months. But even though it was a very severe trial and extremely painful, that I received many realizations, but at a very high cost, very high price. But I would not want to trade those realizations. I wouldn't want to have to go through it again. I wouldn't want to have to do that again. But I would not want to lose those realizations. They were very... it was in my best interest. I always look back that it was the best thing that could have happened. But I wouldn't want that to happen again anytime soon. So that is an important thing, that to see how Krishna always has his hand in everything. So in this case, Yamaraj, now he's very busy, as Prabhupada said, he's always punishing people. Again, he is being an instrument of Lord Krishna. He's punishing people for what? For their own benefit. Not that Krishna is angry with everybody, not that he wants to do them harm, but he is actually benefiting them. By when we experience the suffering of this material world, then we begin to think that this is not our home, this is not our place to be. So he's benefiting them. One point here is that it says that Yamaraj is, let's see, where does it say here? That Yamaraj has his kingdom. Oh yes. But Yamaraj is always busy in his plutonic kingdom, punishing the doers of sinful acts. Now some people have misinterpreted this line, thinking plutonic kingdom means that Yamaraj lives on the planet Pluto. Some people think that. This is not correct. By plutonic kingdom, what is meant here is that the equivalent in Roman and Greek theology of Yamaraj. In Roman theology, he was known as Pluto. And in Greek, he was known as Hades. So Hades means hell. Pluto was the lord of the underworld, of the lord of death. So that is what is meant by plutonic, not that he lived on the planet Pluto. Some people have misinterpreted this. So Yamaraj's fall from Yamaloka was actually to show us that anybody in a position of responsibility should be very careful how they execute judgment. Manu explains in Smriti how the king has to be very careful in his pronouncements, in his judgments, that if he doesn't punish a wrongdoer, then he must accept part of the sin. But if the criminal is actually punished, then the criminal, he goes to Swarga. If he's executed, he is purified, and he goes to Swarga, and the king also gets some punya. Everybody benefits by the punishment of an actual criminal. But if a person who's not a criminal gets punished, you know, if injustice is done, then the criminal, the person who's punished, well, he doesn't get any negativity. But those who are involved, anybody who's lied, anybody who's presented false evidence, the king himself, the judges, they are all implicated in the sin. And they have to suffer greatly. So, Yamaraj, he spent 100 years as Vidura. So it says Aryama took his place in Pitriloka to present, you know, to fulfill his duties. But that means in Aryama's time span, that's only 100 days. Because as we understand from Shastra, the one day of the Devas is 1 year for us, right? One Uttarayana and Dakshinayana is 1 day for the Devas. So though it seems like a long time, it actually wasn't. 100 days is all that he was gone from his job. And he only had 100 days leave of absence. It appears like a long time for us, but it's not a very long time. Just like if we, you know, we wonder why on the battlefield of Kurukshetra, why was it that Abhimanyu died at such a young age? What did he do? What was the reason Abhimanyu died? Well, the reason is explained in Mahabharata, that he was the son of Chandra, of Soma. So everybody was going to take part in Krishna's pastimes. But his father was very attached to his son. So he said, okay, you can go, but you have to be back by a certain time. You know, parents are always telling, okay, you can go out, but you can't stay for too long. So similarly, Chandradev said, okay, you can go, but you have to be back by this time. You know? So therefore, Abhimanyu had a very short pastime. So that was the reason. Not that he did something wrong, just that his father didn't want him to stay very long. So it seems like a long time for us, but it's not a very long time. Aryama is also mentioned in the, let's see. Aryama is mentioned in the fifth canto. He's mentioned in the fifth canto as the main devotee in Hiranya, Hiranyavarsha, where he is the main devotee who is worshipping the Lord. He is one of the, as I said, one of the 12 Adityas. In the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, it describes that there are 33 main devas. There are the 12 Adityas, there is the 11 Rudras, 8 Vasus, and the 2 Ashwini Kumaras. That makes a total of 33. So from them, and also they explain that in the Swargaloka, that there's also Varnashram Dharma. But it's not just Varnashram Dharma is played out in this world, but also in other planets, Varnashram Dharma is there. For example, Brihadaranyaka Upanishad explains that devas like Agni are Brahmanas, whereas others like Indra, Vayu, they are Kshatriyas. The Vasus, they are Vaishyas. And Ashwini Kumars are the Shudras. So this is all through the system, as Krishna explains in the Gita, is all pervasive. Chaturvana Mayasrishtam Guna Karma Vibhagasha. Now one of the main point that Srila Prabhupada makes in this purport is that even though Vidura was born in a Shudra family, born as the son of a Shudra, that no matter what birth a person may take, it is not an obstacle to spiritual advancement. Because there's nothing, there can be no material obstacle for spiritual advancement. That is the nature of spiritual life, that nothing can obstruct it if the person wants to advance. Right? Nothing can obstruct it. So, even though Vidura was the son of a maidservant, because he was an incarnation of Yamaraj, and because he was a great lover of the Pandavas, he was beloved by Lord Krishna. So, if Krishna loves you, then what problem can there be? Krishna specifically said to Duryodhana that because you hate the Pandavas, I won't eat in your house. Those who hate the Pandavas hate me. Those who love the Pandavas love me, and I love them in return. So Vidura loved the Pandavas, therefore Krishna loved Vidura. And because of these various reasons, he was obviously a very great devotee. And it made no difference, you know, the fact that he was born from a Shudra woman. He was always, his brother, Dhritarashtra, always asked for his advice. He was very much beloved by his brother Dhritarashtra, even though sometimes Vidura didn't give him the advice he liked. He was always very much attached to Vidura. Vidura said right in the assembly of the Kauravas that Duryodhan must be killed. Very bold statement to make. Not very sweet words. But he said it. Duryodhan must be killed. If you want to save everyone, Duryodhan must be killed. Duryodhan's own mother said the same thing. Duryodhan must be killed. But Dhritarashtra, because of his attachment, also because of Krishna's desire, could not follow these instructions. But the main thing, as Srila Prabhupada points out here, is that spiritual life, becoming a devotee, is not affected by any material condition. All this varnashram, while it is beneficial for advancing in spiritual life, it sets up a certain system where a person can become a human being. It is meant to transform people into human beings. It sets up a certain, Krishna created the system on purpose so that people could advance. But it is not the ultimate thing. The ultimate thing is to become a devotee of Krishna. As Krishna himself explains in the 18th chapter of the Gita, first he explains in a nutshell what is varnashram. Explains the duties of a Brahmin, explains the duties of a Kshatriya, a Vaishya and Shudra. Then he explains that how can a person become perfect? A person can become perfect if he does his prescribed duty for me. That's called Daivi Varnashram. Because we have seen in history that there were persons who followed Varnashram perfectly, but they were not devotees of Krishna. People like Jarasandha, he perfectly followed Varnashram, but he was not a devotee. That's why earlier in this first canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, Vyasadeva explains that even if someone may follow his duties perfectly, but if he does not develop a taste for hearing the pastimes of Vishvakshena Kata, then it is what? Shama Eva Bikevalam. It's completely useless. Complete useless waste of time. To follow all your duties perfectly, but if you don't develop love for Krishna, it is useless. But if a person is a devotee of Krishna, but they are not ripe, vipaka, if they are not ripe in their devotion, if they are immature in their devotion, and they fall, still there is no loss. There's no loss. They may not have performed their duties perfectly, but because they had some devotion for Krishna, and they fell down, there's no loss, Narada Muni explains to Vyasadeva. So the all-important thing is that devotion to Krishna, advancement in spiritual life, is not dependent on anything material. So, we'll leave. So is there any questions or comments anybody may have?
can write down questions and pass them up if you're shy. No questions? One question. Give him a microphone. What's that? He had to go to Naraka. Yudhishthira, yes. Because he did not follow the order of Krishna to lie, he had to go to Naraka for a short span of time. Actually, he went to heaven, but when he saw in heaven, he saw the Kaurava, he said he preferred to go to hell. Then he went to hell. He preferred to be with the devotees in hell than with the asuras in Swarga. But it was only a short period of time. Any other questions? Yes. What's that?
Whoever is witnessing Krishna, like on the battlefield, many people saw Krishna.
Yes.
They get liberated.
Yes.
Is it true?
Yes.
Then the Kauravas also are
But it's explained that there's five different types of liberation. So they achieved the liberation. It's like they achieved Sayujya Mukti. They entered into the body of Krishna. The same, they're impersonalist. They're like impersonalist. These demons, they just entered into the body of Krishna, but it's Sayujya Mukti. It's not aspired to by devotees.
They went to heaven.
But that's only in the material world. That's not Vaikuntha. Yeah, but that's in the material world. Swarga is in the material world.
Yes.
Everybody falls from Swarga.
After that they went to
No. Swarga is in the material world. People fall from Swarga. The Swarga has many defects. Yes. However, Krishna arranged for it. Swarga has many defects. One time, one rishi, Murgala Rishi, after doing tapasya, the Swarga Duta came to him. He said, okay, now you are ready. We're going to take you, just get on this vimana, and we'll take you to Swarga. So Murgala Rishi was very intelligent. He thought carefully. He said, okay, before I get here, before I go there, you first tell me what are the benefits of Swarga and what are the defects of Swarga. So the Swarga Duta said, why are you asking me so many questions? Just get on. No, he said, I want to know the answer to this question. So then the Swarga Duta began to explain all the various benefits of Swarga. Then he began to explain the defects of Swarga. First of all, when you're in Swarga, you only use up your punya. You can't create any new punya. So it's only a decreasing process. You don't advance. You're just like putting you're only using up your battery, you're not recharging it. So you can do nothing to stay there longer. You're only using up things. That's one defect. Another defect is that everybody in Swarga wears a garland. And when their time is almost up, they notice that their garland fades, wilts. Then they are stricken by panic. Their heart quivers because they know, and very soon they will be thrown down from Swarga. This I think is a very great defect. A great defect. Like that, you know. So he's saying this is the defect because people, they can't stay. And when they find out they're going to leave, they are terrified. So then Murgala Rishi said, he was thinking. Okay, now tell me about some place where when you go there, you don't have to come back. But then the Swarga Duta began to explain about Vaikuntha and Vishnu Loka. Like that. So then he glorified Vaikuntha. But then Murgala Rishi says, he said to the Swarga Duta, no thanks. You can go, I'm not going with you.
But this is one of the reasons why somebody asked one question, why the worship of Indra and the other devas deteriorated? Why you don't see people worshipping Indra anymore? Because when they have these passages in the Mahabharata, you know, or the Bhagavad Gita, so naturally people lost their seeing. They're being told directly that this is not it's a fruitless thing. So after some time, people caught on. It's useless to go to Swarga. So therefore, why people they just stop doing, stop worshiping, they stop the process. Many people just stopped engaging in the process, which would help them to go to Swarga, because they saw it's just a useless place. But, you know, it's not very beneficial to go to Swarga, because it becomes just a vicious cycle, having to come back down again. If even an executed criminal goes to Swarga, what's the benefit? You know, these murderers on death row, when they get executed, they go to Swarga. Do you want to forget about having to do all this punya? Just murder somebody, get executed, you also can go to Swarga. But then you have to come back. Yes.
All the people who were assembled on the battlefield.
Yes, yes.
All of us and other people, they got liberated.
Well, it depends. It depends upon what their mood was. Shalya. Now, Shalya, he was killed on the battlefield, but he was a great devotee of Krishna. So he had a different destination than somebody like Duryodhana. Yeah, Shalya was a great, he was the uncle of the twins. He was the brother of Madri. He was the uncle of the Pandavas. So he died, but he went to Vaikuntha because he was a great devotee. But most of the Kauravas, they were not great devotees. So they were inimical to Krishna. Definitely Duryodhana was inimical to Krishna. He wanted to keep, when Krishna came to Hastinapur to negotiate, first he was very sweetly speaking to Krishna, but when Krishna refused to dine with him, the next thing he tried to do was kidnap Krishna and keep him as a prisoner. But Satyaki foiled the whole plot and Krishna just laughed. So this is the... And then he sent his messenger to the camp of the Pandavas and he was just insulting each one of them, including Krishna, insulting purposely, and told him to repeat the insults over and over and over again. The messenger, before he began giving the message, he said, remember, I'm only a messenger. Don't kill me. But then he began to insult everyone. He began to insult Yudhisthira, Bhima, Arjuna, the Nakula side, Krishna also. That's the message coming from Duryodhana. So obviously, yes, he died. He got liberation, but not the same. He got Sayuja Mukti, which is not aspired for by devotees. He may have gone before to Swarga, but then he got this mukti ultimately. Any other questions? He asked, will the demigods go back to Godhead from their planet? Well, they would. The way it's described is that they eventually, as it comes towards the end of the life of Brahma, they all congregate with Lord Brahma, and all those great souls, like in Jandaloka, they all, if they are deserving, then they will go back to God. They are, all the demigods are expansions of various Vaikuntha personalities. For example, in Goloka, I think it's Sridhama or Sudhama. So in Vaikuntha, he expands as Garuda. And then there's also Garuda in the material world. So obviously, Garuda, he goes back to Godhead. He's already there. You know? Krishna is explained that Krishna is Asama Urdva, that no one is equal to Krishna and no one is above Krishna. Right? But who is above Krishna?
Daksha is somebody who's above Krishna. No, Garuda is always above Krishna. He's got on the Krishna's flag, there's Garuda. So Garuda is always above Krishna. Right? He's good at, because that was one of the, when Garuda met Vishnu, he, that was a boon he asked. I would always want to be above you. So I said, okay, you can be my flag. Garuda Dvaja. So he's always, and then he said, but he's always below Krishna also, because Garuda always is the carrier of Lord Vishnu. So he's both above Krishna and below Krishna simultaneously. There's always more than one way of looking at it. Any other questions? Yes? Say again? The planet Pluto is just a planet. He's been downgraded from a planet, actually. The astronomers. Astronomers have given it a designation. It's not in Shastra. There's so many rocks out there. No. I just made the point. It's not where Yamaraj lives. The designation Plutonic has to do that in Latin, the Romans, the equivalent of Yamaraj in Latin amongst the Romans was the god Pluto. The Greeks, in Greek, he was called Hades. There, you know, there was Zeus. There was Uranus, Poseidon. These were the, you know, Uranus was the god of the sky. Zeus was the equivalent of Indra. Poseidon was the equivalent of Varuna. So in Latin, it would be Zeus was Jupiter, Jove. Jovis, Neptune was equivalent of Poseidon, would be equivalent of Varuna, and so the equivalent of Hades was Pluto, the god of death. So Yamaraj is the god of death, but he doesn't live on the planet. Some astronomers just decided they're going to call this rock floating out there, you know, Pluto, because they named all the planets. So all the planets were. The planets are named the god, the Greek gods are named after the planets. So when these other planets were discovered, you know, starting in the late 1700s, they continued this tradition of naming the planets after the theoi of the Greek gods. So first there was Uranus, which they named. Then the next one they discovered, okay, let's call this one the next one, they call that, you know, Neptune. And it was just a tradition. It has nothing to do with theology or Shastra or nothing like that. It's just the astronomers didn't know what to call them, so they were all learned in the classics in those days. They all studied Greek and Latin. They all knew these. That's what they learned in school, with the classics, the Greek classics, the Roman classics. So they carried on this tradition. But it has nothing to do. It just happens to be that's what they called them, but that's not where Hades, Pluto, the Roman god Pluto does not live on the planet Pluto. The Roman god Neptune does not live on the planet Neptune. The Roman god Uranus does not live on the planet Uranus. They just happen to call it that. Because the astronomers called it that doesn't mean that's where they live. It's just astronomical nomenclature. That's all it is. Yes?
So, I understand that spiritual progress doesn't depend upon anything material.
Say again?
You said that spiritual progress doesn't depend upon anything material.
Yes, I said that spiritual progress does not depend on anything material. That is correct. Yes.
Prabhupada mentioned that to understand Bhagavatam, we should have pure consciousness. So that pure consciousness can be affected by the food we eat.
Say it again.
The consciousness.
Prabhupada said in the first canto that.
The consciousness can be affected by the food that we eat. I just want to.
That consciousness can be affected by the food that we eat. Yeah.
events. The same for in the grow in the village, and they offer Krishna. I don't think that they have more effect if you follow this same process.
So you're saying that the food that they have in the city, the vegetables, everything, because it has various chemicals, herbicides, pesticides, is impure, but that which is grown in the villages is pure. But the food which comes in the cities came from the villages in the beginning. That's they don't have like gardens growing cauliflowers at Kumar Park. You know, like this. they came from the villages. You know, that's where it does come from. But in the villages, they're using pesticides and herbicides. They're not organic gardening. So your point is that if the food is not pure, then it affects our consciousness in a negative way. Right? So there are material contaminants in the food. In the Kali Yuga, everything has become contaminated, isn't it? Everything, the air. We can thank science for air that we can't breathe, water we can't drink, and food that we can't eat. Thank you, science. Isn't it? Back at the turn of the 1900s, people were thinking that, you know, they were thinking that the automobile, the horseless carriage, would be a great benediction because it would stop air pollution. Why is that? Because in the cities, all these horses were dragging the car, and then the horses would, of course, pass stool, would dry on the ground, other wheels would drive over it, turn it into dust, and people would breathe in horse manure. And then they get pneumonia and so many. So they think it was air pollution. They thought the car, the horseless carriage, would eliminate air pollution. But now we've got more air pollution. It's worse. The horses were not destroying the ozone layer, right? Nobody ever fought a war over horses, but they're fighting wars now in the Gulf, right? The oil wars. They're complaining. The Americans are complaining, how can our oil be under their soil? So nobody ever fought about these things. So now they're fighting. So this is what material science has given us. The material solution creates 10 more problems. So even if it is contaminated, Prahlad Maharaj was given food which was poisoned. He still offered it to Krishna, and he ate it. And it was actually poison, enough poison to kill 100 men. But he ate it. So, for vegetarians, now even from a material point of view, they've tested the breast milk of meat eaters and vegetarians. So meat eaters, because the meat is at the top of the food chain, there has a concentration of contaminants in the meat. For the women, you know, carnivore, the breast milk has got high concentration of various toxins. Whereas vegetarians, it's just a tiny little fraction because it's not concentrated. So you wash the food carefully, and you offer it to Krishna. Krishna's much more powerful than that. You know. So we have to take whatever our situation is in, we take it as Krishna prasadam. Prasadam is very powerful. There's one historical incident in the Puranas describing how there was once a famine in the kingdom. In some kingdoms there's a famine. So this Brahmana and his son and wife, they were wandering. They were hungry, they were starving. They came across this old temple and they found some old prasadam there. So they were so hungry that they ate this old food. It was stale, very old, but they were so hungry, it tasted good. The best spice is hunger. It makes everything taste good. My grandmother told me. she used to tell me, what is the best spice? Because she was one time a refugee in the First World War. She had to beg for food from door to door out of hunger. So he said,
She's asking, what is that best spice? And she,
so hungry. So they were so hungry
that they ate this old prasad. Then they continued walking. And then out of the forest, a tiger jumped out of the forest and dragged off the father and ate him. Killed him and ate him. And then the son chased after the tiger and killed the tiger
when he wasn't looking.
And then, but then they saw, going to Vaikuntha, they saw the atma of the father and the atma of the tiger. Why? Because the father had just eaten prasadam and the tiger had just eaten him who had just eaten prasadam.
So they said, they both went to Godhead. Such is the power of prasadam.
So if it's actually prasad, prasadam is just not something you put in front of Krishna. Krishna has to accept it, then it's prasadam. Krishna is not a garbage can. You just throw everything in and he just takes it. It has to be, the consciousness of the person has to be proper. It's the consciousness of the person when they begin. You know, they have to offer it with great, they have to take bath before they cook. There's so many different things there. You know, the kitchen is an extension of the altar. Radharani is in charge of the kitchen. And then you cook very nicely, offer it to Krishna with the best ingredients you can. Krishna Prabhupada explained this one time in Hyderabad. In 1976, there was a program at the farm. And normally there was mass distribution of food to the villagers. Normally Prabhupada didn't take, because he was also sickly. But one time, this time, he asked Harishauri, get me a sample of what they're serving the people. Krishna inspired him to ask this question. So Harishauri went, and as he was going to the kitchen, he was seeing men standing in line with leaf plates, and they threw this like glob of something on the plate. They looked at it and they just threw it on the ground. Then Harishai saw these, you know, like these street dogs you have, these starving street dogs. The street dog came, he looked and he turned away and walked away. Even the starving street, you know. Then and it's all, this is also on tape. This is also on tape. There's a room conversation covering this. If you want to see Prabhupada angry, sometimes people, they make our Prabhupada to be just always ever peaceful. You want to see Prabhupada in the mood of a thunderbolt, you can find this tape, this lecture. When you put it in your tape recorder, the smoke will start coming out. Or your MP3 player will get very hot. So then Harishai went into the kitchen and he saw that the man who he had seen earlier as the bungi was the cook, and he was scraping out of the pot the good part and bringing it home to his family. So Harishai went and reported all of this to Prabhupada, and he brought him some of the stuff, you know. So Prabhupada became furious. He was furious. I mean, everybody was trembling around. Prabhupada's like, he's only like this short, you know. 5 foot, nothing, you know. And everybody was just terrified because Srila Prabhupada was angry. So he calls everybody. And he starts getting on everybody's goes, how you can do this? You know. Prasadam, he just began to explain, prasadam should be so good that even if you are filled up to here, when you see it, you want to eat some. You can't resist. It should be so good. It should be fit for God, not that the dog runs away from it. The dog, I mean, a starving dog rejected it. These dogs are eating, you see what these dogs eat. And then the dog rejected it. How bad it must be. So Prabhupada was just, you know, it should be fit for a king. Fit for a king. Just because we're distributing it to villagers doesn't mean it has to be fit for Krishna. And then somebody made the very lame excuse, "Oh, Srila Prabhupada, we didn't have any money." The Prabhupada immediately says, "You don't have any money? I will give you out of my own pocket. It's for Krishna." So it has to be, you're making this for Krishna. No shortcuts. To the best of your ability, you make it. Whatever you can afford, you make it. And you don't hire some bungee to cook it. It's because the consciousness of the person goes into the food. When we were in Hyderabad, at the temple, they had some hired so-called Brahmin cooking, and everybody was sick. They were sick as dogs from eating that food. It wasn't prasadam. It was just cooked food. And it was not even food, because food is supposed to nourish you. Everybody was getting sick. So then we had to change. We had a devotee, got a devotee cooking. Then everybody was happy. So it does affect your consciousness. But that's a choice. That's your choice. You choose what goes into your mouth. Right? So if you go to somebody's house, you not only look in their refrigerator to see what they eat, but you look on their bookshelf to see what they put into their brain. Right? Because you nourish yourself in many ways. What goes into your mouth, but also what goes into your eyes, what goes into your ears. If they have a television, you know that in their brain is just stool. Because that's what's on television. You just go. You can see how people nourish themselves by looking at their bookshelf and see if they have a television. And they may have Tulsi on their doorstep, but what's could be in the refrigerator, who knows? Meat, beer. So we nourish ourselves in various ways, but it's our choice. If we watch television, if we read, you know, nonsense literature, then that's our choice. That's why there is no material impediment to spiritual life. The impediments are made by us. If we accept it or if we create it, only if we don't want to. There's no impediment. If we want to do something, there is a very interesting story, a true story, about a true story about a French journalist. I heard it on the radio. They announced that this journalist had died after 18 months having suffered a stroke. He suffered a stroke 18 months earlier, then he died. But they said in that 18 month period, you know, he had a very severe stroke. He was totally incapacitated. He could only move his left eyelid. Not even his right eyelid. His right eyelid was closed. Nothing, no other parts of his body moved. The only part of his body that moved was his left eyelid. But, they said, before he died, in that 18 months, he wrote a book of 150 pages. So how could he do that? He had a friend. His friend had a board with the alphabet. He moved his finger. When he came to the right letter, he blinked his eye. So, this man, to perform something material, he was so determined, he wrote a book one letter at a time, one blink at a time. So if you want to do something, nothing can stop you. But if you don't want to do something, everything will stop you. You won't even get up. So it all depends upon us. It's all dependent upon desire. This enterprise of Krishna consciousness is based upon controlling our mind, as it's explained in the 6th chapter of the Gita. We have to control it. It's based upon our determined effort. I mean, Krishna consciousness means that we make the effort to conform our mind to the mind of Krishna. That's what Krishna consciousness means. We conform our mind, we think of Krishna and conform our mind to His mind. That is Krishna consciousness. The perfect example of this is given in the Krishna book of that as Pradyumna, Krishna's son. It's described that Pradyumna, if he found out that he liked something, but Krishna didn't like it, then guess what? Pradyumna didn't like it anymore. But then if Pradyumna didn't like something, but found out that Krishna liked it, now Pradyumna liked it. He conformed his mind to that of Krishna. That's Krishna consciousness. That means that we have to make a conscious decision to do that. You know? As my godbrother Tamal Krishna said, before you can become Krishna conscious, you have to become conscious. Right? You have to first become conscious, then you can become Krishna conscious. So we have to make that decision. It's our choice. It's not always easy. But if we want to, if this man could write a book one blink at a time, that means he had determination. He had a desire, strong desire. So when we develop that strong desire, then we'll also, you know, when we begin to understand, when we begin to experience, you know, that's why Krishna makes this world so miserable. So we don't want to stay. We begin to become disgusted with this material life. Then we make the effort to leave. And then when we make the effort to leave, and we know that we are making a journey out of this material world, then it's also easier to tolerate things. Because, you know, I'm not staying here, I'm leaving. Why I should get too so upset about all these things? Right? I was talking to my physiotherapist yesterday, so I was explaining this point to him, that he was in the military for 20 years. But when he was retiring, during retirement, say 6 months before his retirement, there was so much things which were going on, but he didn't care because he knew 6 months from now he's walking out the gate. Why he should get upset? Because he knows he's leaving the place. So he was detached. But if it had been the beginning of his 20-year service, he would have been totally upset. Because he has to live and he's thinking, I'm staying here. But when you're thinking you're leaving, you're not going to be upset about it. You just do what you have to do and then you're going. You're thinking, you're already in your mind, you're left. You've already gone. You know, you're already planning what you're going to be doing. And you just tolerate all the craziness that's going on around you. So if we're thinking, if we're already meditating where we're going, then we can tolerate this. This is a very crazy place that we're living in. If we hadn't noticed it. Totally crazy place. Crazy and full of misery. So many problems. But if we are fixed that this is not our home, and we are going someplace else, then it makes it significantly more tolerable. But if you're thinking, this is where I live, this is where I'm going to stay, then you'll get all upset, you get all angry when you see all this crazy stuff. And you'll get, you know, so many bad feelings, you'll want to kill people and who knows what. You see all these different, you know, terrorists, they're all upset. They think they live here. They think this is their house, they think this is their home, and so they want to change it to the way they want it to be. Any other questions? No more questions? Oh, one more question. Huh? Who qualifies to go to Pitriloka? It's explained in different shastras like Mahabharata and Ramayana that those persons who do punya, you know, pious material activities, and whose descendants do the Pitritarpana, Shraddha ceremonies, they go to Pitriloka and they stay in Pitriloka as long as their descendants are performing that tarpana. That was the case of, as we see in the case of Agastya Rishi. Agastya Rishi was living in the forest as a tapasvi. He was just happy.
is a brahmachari living in there. And there's also another, there's two rishis. This happened in this two cases, like Jatukarna and Agastya Rishi. So both the same thing happened to them. So Agastya Rishi, one time he went and he saw in this hole, he saw all these devas, pitris, hanging upside down, and there was a very thin thread that was being gnawed on by a rat. And he became very concerned, very compassionate. He says, "What's happening? Why are you like this?" It's because our descendant is not doing he's not had any children, and is not doing the Pitri Shraddha, we're going to fall into hell because of that. And he says, who is the descendant of yours? I'll go and tell him. He says, well, as a matter of fact, you are the descendant of ours who is not having any children, you know. So then he became very, both of them, Agastya and Jatukarna, they both became very concerned what to do. So then Agastya Rishi, he made all kinds of arrangements. Says, who am I going to marry? There's no girl suitable for me. So then he created a girl, Lopamudra, and he put her soul in the body of her father, and then the whole thing, and so like that. But then what happens is, if in Pitri Loka, the Pitris do not get the Tarpana, the Shraddha from their from their descendants, what happens? They become deformed, they become angry. They are the ones who turn into the Yamadutas, because their descendants don't give them proper nourishment. They become angry and they turn into the Yamadutas, because Yamaraj is in charge of Pitriloka. And that's where Yamadutas come from. Pitris who have got bad nourishment, they become very angry and ugly. I think we should end here. One more question, one last question. You have to come, you have to speak up a little louder or give her a microphone. I can't hear.
Is it necessary that we have to do the Pitrita?
You have Srimad Bhagavatam here? The Bhagavad Gita? There is a verse, I can't find it right away, from the 11th canto. Okay, I found it. It's in the purport of 2nd chapter, verse 38. And it's a quotation from Srimad Bhagavatam, 11th canto, 5th chapter, verse 41. Devarshi bhutapta nrinam pitrinam nakinkaro nayam rini charajan sarvatmanatyas sharanam sharanyam gato mukundam parityakartam kartam. Translation: anyone who has completely surrendered unto Krishna, Mukunda, giving up all other duties, is no longer a debtor, nor is he obliged to anyone, not the demigods, nor the sages, nor the people in general, nor kinsmen, nor humanity, nor the Pitris. So one time, a few years ago, I was in Srirangam. And that day, it just so happened that several of the Sri Vaishnava Brahmanas I was with, they were all the oldest sons of their fathers, and so they were doing their Pitri Tarpana, using, the black till seeds, etc., etc. So one of the boys, he asked his father, because I told him, we don't, in Gaudiya Sampradaya, we don't do this. So he asked his father, why Shamsundar, why he's not doing that? So his father replied, because I was chanting my japa,
He's always chanting Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. He doesn't need to do these things. That's what his father told. He doesn't need to do these things because he's always chanting Maha Mantra. Of course, he's thinking that way, but because he's always done. So, and also the thing is, amongst the Sri Vaishnavas, they do these things as part of their Varna Ashram. They're doing it to please Krishna. Like that. They're doing it to please Krishna. Like Prithu Maharaj, he performed so many sacrifices, not because he necessarily he didn't worship the devas. He did it as an example for other people. But for Vaishnavas, those who are sincerely following in the path of devotional service, they don't have to do this. Because, you know, who is our Pitri? Who is our ultimate Pitri Devata? We are in the Achyuta Gotra. So who is our Pitri? Achyuta. So every day you're worshipping him, right? When you become a Vaishnava, you enter into the Achyuta Gotra. So every day you're doing, if you're offering your food, that means every day you're offering to your Pitri. And if he's accepting, he's becoming very fat. Your deity should become very chubby. Like you see, if you go to London, Ishwara, and Soho Street Temple, they're very fat. They're very fat deities. Prabhupada's favorite deities. He said that somebody was trying to get him to say that Radha, Vrindavan, Chandra were that Radha, London, Ishwara have town beauty and Radha, Vrindavan, Chandra have country beauty. But on the original second canto, the cover was Radha, London, Ishwara. They're very fat. Because they're accepting the food, the bhoga. So that is he is our Pitri Devata. That's why we don't have to ultimately do shraddhas and this type of thing. You can, of course, offer on behalf of your father or your ancestor, you can offer them prasad if you want to benefit them. But the best benefit you can do is like Prahlad Maharaj. By becoming a Vaishnava, he liberated so many previous generations of his ancestors. That is the best offering. So for us, because we are now in the Achyuta Gotra, every time we offer food, we're offering it to our Pitri Devata, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Krishna himself says, of the Pitris I am Aryama, of great wielders of weapons I am Lord Ram. So even of the Pitris, Krishna is the Supreme One. Alright, do you want to take any more questions? He did. Yeah, but it was also a lila, otherwise how is he going to meet Ishwara Puri? He did it. There's no harm in doing it, but as long as you don't think that it's not a necessary duty for a Vaishnava. And that was before Lord Chaitanya became a Vaishnava, although he's God. That was before his lila of becoming a Vaishnava. He went there and then he got initiated. Before that he was a Nyayaka. Isn't it? Before, it's by going there, that's when he met Ishwara Puri, then he became initiated as a Vaishnava. Not after he became a Vaishnava he went there, it was before he became a Vaishnava. Isn't it? Of course, that is his lila. Yeah, but nobody, it's after he did that lila, he went before he became a Vaishnava. And at Bodh Gaya, he met Ishwara Puri. Then he became transformed. Then he became a Vaishnava. They noted because the difference was after he came. Alright, we'll end the class now.
Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, Srimad Bhagavatam Gantaraj Ki Jaya.